that mind's Tehran hosting a conference on Afghan neighbors. Iran says Afghanistan needs to install a government that is all-inclusive. Beijing rejects Washington's call for including Taiwan in UN institutions as simply unworkable. China says Taiwan is part of China, and only sovereign states can join the UN. And protesters in northwest England want to see an Israeli arms company shut down for complicity in war crimes against Palestinians. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. We begin this hour in Tehran where a one-day conference of Afghan neighbors is underway as we speak. The foreign ministers of six neighboring states plus Russia are attending the event. A while ago, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made opening speech. There he called on the participants to throw their weight behind an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan. He said the current problems are the outcome of years of U.S. disastrous conduct in Afghanistan. UN Chief Antonio Guterres, who also virtually addressed the conference, called for a unified approach towards the Afghan crisis. Top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries, namely China, Tajikistan, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, in addition to Russia, have all delivered speeches. They're demanding international cooperation for bringing stability to the country and safeguarding the rights of Afghan people. We're going to cross over now to our correspondent, Yusuf Jalami, who is at the venue of the conference on Afghanistan in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Yusuf, please walk us through the key points of today's conference and what was said by the visiting foreign ministers, the respective foreign ministers of Afghanistan's neighbors.
Well, of course, Radia, it's a very important summit held in Tehran today on ways to tackle the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan. Six neighbors of Afghanistan plus Russia, of course, took part today in the summit. Russia and China took part in the summit via video conference, but the rest attended the conference in person. So the bottom line of the conference is Afghanistan needs to have a government that is all-encompassing, inclusive, reflecting the interests of all ethno-political parties and groups in Afghanistan. That is the stance that is shared by all of the countries attending the conference today. Afghanistan has witnessed violence for two decades, and now, after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Afghanistan and the takeover of Taliban, we also witnessed a series of terrorist attacks claimed by the Daesh terrorists affiliate in Afghanistan, known as the ISK, a terror group that was responsible for the killing of dozens, if not hundreds, of people in two mosques in Kandahar and Kunduz recently. So the participants here in the conference said that they do not tolerate violence, more violence in Afghanistan. They, of course, attributed, especially Iran, the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, attributed the recent violence claimed by Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan as a way for the American officials to, of course, tell the world that without the American troops in Afghanistan, Afghanistan will not be safe. That is why they are supporting the Daesh terror groups to, of course, be again present in Afghanistan and carry out such terror attacks in Afghanistan, kill dozens of Shia Muslims in two mosques in a couple of weeks ago. So the conference aims to establish an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan and also to find ways to restore peace and stability in Afghanistan. So the conference wrapped up minutes ago, and now we are in a different hall in the Iranian Foreign Ministry, expecting the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian to brief us on the discussions that took place in the Foreign Ministry and to tell us about the latest agreements that have been achieved by different countries who are who participated in the conference. Now, of course, we have the chance to ask questions. The press conference is slated for 10 minutes later. So we're going to be there in the conference asking questions from the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian about the conference, about the recent ways adopted by the Islamic Republic of Iran and this the five member and the five, of course, neighbors of the Afghanistan about ways to, of course, restore peace and stability to the Afghan nation, and of course, about ways to establish an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan. We saw that the Chinese foreign minister and the Russian foreign minister also delivered an address via video conference. They were not attending the conference in person. They attended it via video conference. The Chinese foreign minister said that his country is willing to host the third round of talks about Afghanistan, because this Tehran summit is the continuation of earlier talks held in September between Afghanistan's neighbors, held in September, where the participants at that conference also read out a joint statement which called for an inclusive government. Afghanistan is a country that hosts different ethnic minorities and religious minorities, so the government needs to address the interests of all those minorities. Without such a government, the parties, the participants in the conference said that peace and stability will not come back to Afghanistan and the Afghan people.
All right, thanks a lot, Yusuf. That was our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran, for further insights on the importance of today's conference. We're now bringing an author and geopolitical analyst, Mr. Greg Simons, who's joining us from Uppsala. Mr. Simons, welcome to the program. First of all, I'd like to get your thoughts on some of the points that were brought up by the visiting foreign ministers. An all-inclusive government in Afghanistan is a must. That was reiterated time and again by the visiting officials. And also, a lot of blame was put on the United States for the situation that Afghanistan is in right now. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, this conference demonstrates two key and critical points. If you want to look at it from a geopolitical perspective and a security perspective, one is the fact that this conference is taking place illustrates the declining power and influence of the Western-centric U.S. unipolar order and the rise of influence and power of this non-Western-centric multipolar order within global politics and international relations. And this case of Afghanistan is yet another critical test to consolidate this transformation of global geopolitics. And if we look at Afghanistan itself, it's not only a matter of Afghani security and stability, because Afghanistan's security and stability also has wider implications for Eurasia, the neighbouring countries, and even beyond. And the United States does know this, and their way of ruling is usually to create chaos and disorder, and from that chaos and disorder, divide and rule different groups. And I think this is what they're going to try and do. It's what they've done in the past. The indications are from their strategy, for example, opposing sanctions, the usual tactics. They have every intention of doing this yet again.
There's another issue, Mr. Simon, before we leave, that was brought up. Iran reiterated that the United States should release the funds of Afghanistan. As we know at this point, the future makeup of the relationship between the United States and the Taliban at this point is a bit unclear. Do you think that they're using these funds as a bargaining chip or as some sort of leverage for the near future?
Yes, they're playing the role of a powerful broker. So they're trying to use this to coerce, to force things on the Taliban which are not in their interest. And this is coming back to the second point I was making before, to create this instability which will create a divide and rule which would benefit the U.S. and no one else.
All right, thanks a lot. Author and geopolitical analyst Greg Simons joining us from Uppsala. Moving on, fury and reaction coming out of Beijing as Washington steps up efforts to include Taiwan in the UN. The Chinese government objects, saying the issue is simply out of the question because a self-ruling island is part of China. The UN is composed of sovereign states, Beijing says, adding the People's Republic of China is the only legal government representing entire China. The Taiwan Affairs Office is advising Taipei against relying on Washington for independence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has criticized Taiwan's exclusion from the UN, urging member states to support the island's inclusion in the international body. Taiwan was formally expelled from the UN by a resolution of the General Assembly in 1971. The resolution recognizes the representative of the Beijing government as China's only legitimate representative to the UN. The UK is home to some of the world's biggest weapons manufacturers, among them Israel's Elbit system. Saeed Pedersen has traveled to one of the company's factories in northwest England that's facing growing calls to close up shop. Let's have a look.
They're small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down. This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here, organized by several pro-Palestinian groups who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza. Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK, including four factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK, and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham, causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrest, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed.
The Palestinian people are losing their lives. What's jail? What is a court? I already know that what I'm doing is right. I'm already on the right side of history. If I end up in court, I don't need some judge to tell me whether I've done the right thing or the wrong thing. If I go to jail trying to save the lives of the Palestinian people, so be it.
Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine. Saeed Pedersen, London.
The United States has expressed concern over Israel's decision to build 1,300 new settler units in the occupied West Bank.
We strongly oppose the expansion of settlements, which is completely inconsistent with efforts to lower tensions and to ensure calm, and it damages the prospects for a two-state solution. We also view plans.
Ned Price also said the U.S. views as unacceptable the regime's plans for legalization of illegal outposts. The criticism followed a similar statement from the European Union. Israel announced the plan on Friday. That's why all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law as they are built on occupied Palestinian land. The UN Security Council in several resolutions has called for a halt to Israel's settlement activities. Commentator Paul Arudi says Washington's apparent disapproval of Israel's plans to build more settlements in the occupied West Bank is anything but sincere and will not cost the regime anything.
The United States under Biden wants to show some degree of independence from Israel, trying to differentiate itself from the Trump regime, which never criticized Israel, and it's trying to show some unanimity with the European Union. But Israel, in fact, is running things, and the only thing the United States is doing is registering a complaint, disapproval, if you will. It's not as if it's going to make Israel pay a price for this. Not at all.
Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned what it called the UN inaction over Saudi crimes in Yemen. The council has called on the UN to end its support for the former government of Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, saying it does not represent the interests of the Yemeni people. Abdulatif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can then tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. The article you're about to hear has been published by the New York Times opinion section. The article has been written by Benjamin Applebaum, the lead writer on economics and business for the New York Times editorial board. The piece is titled, "The Rotten Core of the Republican Party." Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. Well, yes, Democrats want Americans to pay the full amount they owe in taxes. What doesn't get enough attention is that many Republicans seem not to agree. Resistance to taxation is the rotten core of the modern Republican Party. Republicans in recent decades have sharply reduced the federal income tax rates imposed on wealthy people and big companies. But their opposition to taxation goes beyond that. They are actively aiding and abetting tax evasion. Republicans have hacked away at funding for the Inland Revenue Service, the IRS, over the past decade, enfeebling the agency. When the rich and powerful open loopholes in the tax code, Republicans reliably fight to keep the loopholes open. Indeed, they valorize Americans who find ways to pay less, a normalization of antisocial behavior that may be even more damaging than their efforts at bureaucratic sabotage. Former President Donald Trump's loud and proud declaration that paying very little in taxes makes me smart was just a more brazen articulation of what has become party orthodoxy. The Democratic proposal targeted by Kevin McCarthy in the video he posted online, he actually calls it un-American, would make it harder for wealthy people to cheat on their taxes. The Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, estimated in 2019 that Americans conceal from taxation more than half of income that is not subject to some form of third-party verification, like a W-2, the form that the government uses to verify ordinary wage income. This blind spot costs the federal government hundreds of billions of dollars in unpaid taxes. In comparison, more than 95% of wage income is reported. Under the current version of the Democrats' plan, which is part of the Biden administration's sweeping Build Back Better legislation, banks would be required to submit annual reports on accounts with total inflows and outflows exceeding $10,000, excluding paychecks and government benefits. The banks would report the total amount deposited in the account and the total amount withdrawn. There would be no reporting of individual transactions. The information would give the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, a better chance to catch cheaters. And it would provide a salutary reminder for people to pay what they owe. The Biden administration recently cemented an international agreement to establish a 15% global minimum tax on corporate income. The long-sought deal would reduce the incentive for American firms to evade taxation by pretending to generate revenue in low-tax havens like Ireland and roughly half of the islands in the Caribbean. A practice that has become all but business as usual in industries with intangible products like finance, technology, and pharmaceutical research. The minimum corporate tax, like the bank reporting requirement, is not aimed at increasing what is owed. It is aimed at collecting what is owed already. Improving tax collection was another important benefit. Democracy and capitalism rest on a lacework of mutual obligation. People fulfill their own responsibilities because they're confident others will too. Collecting taxes, especially from the rich and powerful, is an affirmation of that faith. Felicia Wong, the president of the Roosevelt Institute, a progressive think tank based in New York, said that the corporate tax agreement, which includes 136 countries, is valuable as a demonstration that governments have the ability to impose their will on multinational corporations in the service of the public interest. A hopeful model for confronting other problems like climate change. It can and should create more faith in governance, she said. Both plans, however, must overcome the united opposition of congressional Republicans. The Republican Party was reborn in the 1970s under the banner of resistance to taxation, led by anti-tax men like Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan. It remains the party's fixation, the one major area of policy on which congressional Republicans were able to agree upon during the Trump administration. By way of ideological justification, Republicans like to talk about liberty, by which they mean a narrow and negative kind of freedom from civic duty and mutual obligation. But the fervent opposition to taxation has always found its deeper wellsprings of motivation in concern about how the money will be spent. In the bellwether case of California, the rise of anti-tax activism was inextricably intertwined with the decline of a white electoral majority. It wasn't a question of whether Americans should ever be required to help one another. The real question was, who would be helped? Opposition to progressive income taxation also draws strength from an imagined democratic ideal in which the people who vote for taxation, pay the taxes, and get the benefits are all one and the same. History tells a very different story, though. From the outset, taxation in the United States was designed as an antidote to inequality. The government initially chose to raise revenue through tariffs, collecting from wealthy merchants. The introduction of a federal income tax in the early 20th century was a different means to the same end. In a historical analysis published last year, a pair of German political scientists, Laura Zielkop and Hannah Leeser, showed that progressive taxation is a hallmark of democratic governance. Political philosophers have long fretted that democracy allows the poor to plunder the rich. Your opposite has proved more nearly true. Progressive taxation is not a threat to the wealthy. It is a small price to pay for prosperity. Cutting taxes to staff social programs is, by itself, a threat to the sustainability of the American experiment in multicultural democracy. In enabling resistance to lawful taxation, Republicans are engaged in an even more direct assault on democracy. Having failed to constrain government spending through the democratic process, they are seeking to undermine government itself. Representative Kevin McCarthy is right to frame a fairly technical change in tax rules as an issue that goes to the heart of American democracy. Democracies impose higher taxes than other forms of government because democracies are communities of common purpose. We create and maintain our society through our contributions. Or we don't, and things fall apart. Thank you.
us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instruments.
The Spotlight.
In Sudan, ralliers remain on the streets in protest at the Monday military coup d'etat. They want the 2019 transition deal to be honored. On Monday, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan announced dissolving civilian rule and a state of emergency. Civilian cabinet ministers, including the prime minister, have been arrested. Soldiers have gone down at least seven protesters. General Burhan argues that the coup was justified to avoid a civil war. The coup has drawn global condemnation, and the UN Security Council is due to discuss the situation today. Now, to start with, let's go to London to our correspondent, Ahmed Kabbalah, and see what he has for us.
Yes, so we finally heard from the mastermind behind the coup, General Al-Burhan. He said that a new sovereign council will be formed in the next couple of days, a new prime minister will be appointed, as well as new judicial bodies. He's also said that he is committed to, quote-unquote, the transition to democracy, and he hopes to have election in 2023. Now, unfortunately for him, the Sudanese people are not buying this. There's been calls for a general strike, civil disobedience. The protests that have been going on since the military coup has been announced, and the people are fed up. You're seeing on social media, many people are talking about it. Sudan has been the number one trending topic, not only in Sudan, but around the world, following the news of the coup. And many people believe that this is a power grab, and the new sovereign council will be handpicked to serve the military's interests. The new judicial body will be handpicked, the new prime minister will be handpicked. The prime minister, Hamdok, has been taken to an undisclosed location. And the reason why, according to Burhan's statement, he was taken there was because he refused the ultimatums given to him by the military. One of those ultimatums was to read out a pro-coup statement live on air. The prime minister refused and he was arrested. The information minister, who I interviewed this time last year for Press TV, has also been detained and taken to a undisclosed location.
I see. Ahmed, I hear that you're of Sudanese descent yourself. So how would you feel, as somebody belonging to Sudan and the people there, to see so many coup d'etats in Sudan taking place and the military not being ready actually to let go of power and to let a civilian government to take power?
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. Since 1956, when Sudan first got its independence, we've had three revolutions, one in 1964. Soon after that revolution, there was a military coup d'etat in 1969. We had another revolution in 1985. Soon after that, there was a military coup in 1989 when Omar al-Bashir took power. And then we had another revolution at the end of this of 2018, and once again we saw another military coup d'etat. And it suggests that we need top to bottom reform in the military, because they don't see their role as strictly protecting the country, but rather governing the country. And regardless of what decade it is in Sudanese history, it seems the military want to call the shots and dictate, and are not willing to take orders from civilian-led government. And I think that this was not only predictable, but was inevitable, and it needs the Sudanese people to basically win back the gains that they made with the December 2018 revolution.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Kabbalah, our correspondent in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
From London, let's bring in a guest. We have publisher of the Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofai-Ensah. Good to have you with us, Jonathan. So did this recent coup d'etat in Sudan catch you by surprise? You know, I'm asking this because there were many who were expecting this to happen.
Yes, I mean, the signs were there, judging from the mass demonstrations that took place last week and the week before. I mean, the people rightly sensed, you know, or saw the undercurrents that were going on and sort of held preemptive demonstrations, you know, against such an eventuality. But unfortunately, you know, they couldn't help, and this coup took place on Monday. And like your correspondent said, the military staged the coup just because they wanted to dictate, you know, the pace of reforms. They wanted to dictate everything that goes on within the country. And again, they feared being exposed because, look, most of these military are tainted. You take the war in Darfur, you take other sleaze that has taken place within the economy and so on and so forth. Most of them are tainted and wanted to protect themselves. And it appeared Abdallah Hamdok, the deposed prime minister, wasn't one who was prepared to play ball with them. So the only alternative left to them was to stage this coup and get rid of Hamdok, right, and place their own handpicked people, you know, in place. They've announced a new civilian government that will work alongside them. They've announced a planned judicial council, and all the members of these bodies are going to be handpicked by, or are going to be people who will be handpicked by this General Benham, and who will play their ball, will play their game, will work according to the dictates of the military.
Okay, now, author and journalist Robert Fantina is also joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. I should say welcome to Robert. And Robert, you know that General Burhan was supposed to cede control of the ruling council to civilian leaders in a few weeks' time. Instead, he dissolved the council. He announced a date for elections, after which he said he would hand over to an independent and fair representative, in his own words. Now, is the military really serious about handing power over to civilian rulers? If so, why did they do it in a few weeks' time that they were supposed to do?
They are not serious about doing this, about handing power over to civilian leaders. If they were, as you said, they would have done it on the schedule that was agreed upon 2 years ago when the Bashar was overthrown and the coalition government was formed. But the fact that Burhan has now seized the government and is promising to have elections and hand over the government to civilians in another 2 years is not promising. It's not optimistic. This is going to be another military leadership, as the people of Sudan have had to put up with for decades before. They want democracy. They've demonstrated for democracy. It's what the people want, and it's what the government had promised to them. And now General Al-Burhan has violated that promise, and I don't believe he has any intention of respecting it at any time in the future.
Now, Jonathan, the general leading the coup d'etat is saying that he did what he did in order to avoid a civil war. Is he in the right?
He is partly right, yes, because when the civilian population started, you know, their demonstrations earlier, middle of this month, you know, up to last week or whatever, yes, if those demonstrations had gone ahead, yes, chances were, you know, it could have escalated into some sort of a military confrontation. So in a way, he's right. But then, I believe the demonstrations by the civilian population leading up to last week also played into his hands. It was like, in my language, I can't go to Ghana. It's like, you know, when the mosquito wants to, you know, to enter your bedroom, you know, it follows, and the wind blows, it gives you the chance to enter your bedroom and bite you. So this is something that, you know, has happened in Sudan. The demonstrations actually played into General Benham's hands to say this could, this coup d'etat on the pretext of avoiding a possible civil war.
Robert, military leaders are saying that an election will be held in July 2023 in which power will be transferred to a civilian government. You know, multiple coup d'etats have been staged in Sudan in the past 3 decades, so it makes me wonder if a peaceful transition in Sudan would ever be feasible.
It's challenging, certainly. The issues that face the Sudanese people are many and complex. This is, as you mentioned, the fourth such a coup that the Sudanese nation has experienced in a relatively short amount of time. The elections could be held and could be reasonable, could be valid and democratic if the governing leaders choose to allow them to be such. General Al-Burhan does not seem to be someone who would encourage that based on the fact that he has taken this move today or in the last couple of days. He was scheduled to transition, the country was scheduled to transition to a civilian government next month, is something that he has now prevented, and he has pushed it off for 2 more years. There were, as your other commentator mentioned, problems in the nation, as there will continue to be. However, growth is not always smooth and simple, and the Sudanese people needed to get through these difficult times to begin their civilian government in November. This has now been defeated. Whether or not civilian government will come to power following elections in July of 2023 remains to be seen, but none of the evidence that has been demonstrated so far, that has represented so far, supports the idea that that will actually happen.
Okay, now let me ask Jonathan this. Jonathan, you know that the agreement between civilian and military leaders signed in 2019 was meant to push Sudan toward democracy, but it faced a number of coup attempts. So what's responsible for all of this, and is democracy possible in Sudan?
I believe democracy is possible in Sudan because the Sudanese people appear to be very politically aware. We shouldn't forget that, before I go, we shouldn't forget that it was the people, actually the demonstrations, the protests, or the sustained protest, the demonstrations of the people that precipitated the downfall of Al-Bashir, okay? Mm-hmm. So I believe the people of Sudan, the Sudanese people, want and demand democracy. So that sheer force of their will make sure that, aided by Western influences. Already the U.S. has suspended about $700 billion of aid, okay? And if Sudan's allies in the Middle East, Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, also, you know, put some pressure on this junta, I believe they'll follow the timetable and usher in, you know, a democratic dispensation. I believe there's a light at the end of the tunnel where democracy is concerned, at least. Because of the sheer will of the Sudanese people, democracy will be attained in the long run.
Robert, do you see eye to eye with Jonathan, and how can we be rest assured that the military will not repeat the same scenario it did just today in 2023 when the, you know, transition is going to take place?
Be sure that won't happen. In fact, I'm very pessimistic about the possibility of the transition to democracy in 2023 under the current military regime that has just taken over. The idea of the fact that the United States has withheld $700 million in aid, other countries may do the same, is going to make things difficult for the people of Sudan, but not necessarily for the government of Sudan. It depends on how repressive the military government chooses to be. We've seen the United States in the past cease foreign aid, issue sanctions, and so on. this has never brought about the desired result of a regime change. The United States always winds up going in militarily to overthrow governments. So I don't see that the U.S.'s withholding of foreign aid will have a significant impact on the government. It will certainly on the people, but how the government reacts to it remains to be seen. Sudan has other powerful allies that have not expressed a great amount of disapproval of this coup. I'm talking about Russia and China. They're both looking at it and cautiously, and the Russian spokesman have said that the inefficiency of the pending or of the coalition government that had been in effect for a while is what caused this coup. I don't think that's the case, but I don't see Sudan's other powerful allies withdrawing from it at this time.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jonathan, speaking of the U.S., you know that the country removed Sudan from state sponsor of terror lists last year, and in June, it also paid a $50 billion debt relief package to Sudan. Now, some believe that this is aimed at kind of encouraging Sudan to sign the so-called normalization deal with the Tel Aviv regime. Your take on that?
Yes, I mean, it was a sweetener. Already, General Benham, when Netanyahu was prime minister, had a trilateral talks with Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Okay, and again, Pompeo, the then Secretary, U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, also called Benham to congratulate him, you know, on trying to normalize relations with Israel. Yes, I believe this normalization will happen, because already everything has been set in motion. So I believe even it hasn't happened already, it will happen eventually. So, and to go back to the other guy in Canada, look, what I said was that the sheer force of the will of the Sudanese people will make sure, because the only resistance that the military will show would be to kill, you know, the civilians, to kill the protesters. And the more they do that, the more isolated they will be, right? And the more, you know, even their allies might turn against them. So they will need to, the people demonstrating, asking for a return to civilian rule, will put much pressure, internal pressure, and also bring in external pressure for the military regime to make way for a democratic disposition in the long run. Maybe not in the medium term, but hopefully in the long term, in the long run, the democratic disposition will be allowed to take place.
Okay. Now, Robert, what do you think? Will Sudan be signing normalization deal with Tel Aviv regime, and how will the people react?
Well, I think, as your other commentator said, that Sudan will sign the normalization. As with other countries, Arab countries that signed such normalization, of course, Sudan is an African country, but with a large Muslim population. But as other countries did, the people protested. It was not what the people in the countries wanted, but it was done for political expediency, often at the behest of the United States. Sudan will do for the same reasons, despite what the people of Sudan want. The United States will continue to fund the Sudanese government as long as it does the U.S.'s bidding. And one of the very important things to the United States is for Israel to not be marginalized in the world community, as it is increasingly due to its genocidal practices against the Palestinians, its constant violations of international law, and its crimes against humanity. The United States is willing to overlook those and will bribe other countries to overlook them too, and will probably be successful with Sudan. Okay. Regardless of who is running the country.
Right. Now, one final question for both of you. Jonathan, who would benefit from a Sudan that's in disarray and chaos?
Nobody benefits. You know, the Sudanese people will lose. And I don't see anybody benefiting. I mean, it will be losses all around.
Mm-hmm. And Robert?
I agree with that. The Sudanese people will suffer from this chaos. They will be unable to get foreign aid. As we've mentioned before, many countries will probably stop foreign aid because of this coup, at least for a time, and those people will suffer. the United States may decide to go in militarily under what it will say are humanitarian causes, which is what the United States does at different times and just makes things much worse than they ever were. But in order to get any oil or to prevent exports to Russia and China, the United States may do that. So this is a lose-lose situation for everybody.
Okay, Jonathan, would you foresee a U.S. intervention in Sudan?
I don't see U.S. Intervening militarily, but maybe diplomatically to try to exert some diplomatic pressure on the military.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had publisher of the Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofeansa from London, and also author and journalist Robert Fantina in Kitchener, Ontario. I've been your host, Behu Snyderfi, and I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام من هوان الدنيا على الله أنه لا يعصى إلا فيها ولا ينال ما عنده إلا بتركها.
Imam Ali said, "It is the proof of the humbleness of the world before Allah that Allah is disobeyed only herein, and His favors cannot be achieved except by abandoning it." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we find in the very words of Imam Ali alayhi salam